So, what's this about? This is really, I was going to talk to you about some things I've made. I've made a bunch of things for hacker camps and maker fairs and watched what people have done with them and seen how they've turned out. So I was going to talk about the things, about things I've learned from them, ways to make them, and ways to make them more effective, and maybe a bit of a manifesto about these kinds of things. So who am I? I mostly make software for a living. I make stuff, all kinds of stuff, and if you make stuff and you've got computers, you make robots. That's kind of how it goes. I've done computers forever. We made BugMe a long time ago. That's the oldest published software I could find. But I'm not going to talk about software much today. Making stuff, I've always done. Usually I never had a plan. I just wanted to make a thing because I had an idea. And if you have an idea, you have to make the thing. That's just how it is. So just ordinary stuff, luggage and furniture. And that's part of a fighter jet with part of a chair stuck onto it. Stuff, cutlery. I really like cutlery. I don't know. Nobody else makes cutlery to see how it comes out except me. So robots, right, this is what we're here for, is really putting computers in stuff that you make. Here is the first example of a thing that was like these exhibitions, these exhibits. I made this with my friend Ben for an exhibition in Bristol. It's a little eyeball that looks at people. That's all it does, right? That's its whole thing. It looks at people and it blinks. It's not very clever, but people seem to like it. So it's interesting to watch what they did with it. So they often, they loved it when they first saw it for, you know, 5 seconds or 15 seconds. They were very taken with it and they'd look at it and they'd play with it. They'd go and wave at it, try and work out what it knew, and they'd move around and do little dances. Occasionally the cunning ones, if there were two of them, they'd like go different ways and see what happened. In this case, it actually averages them, so it looks in the middle, which is a fail. But so they were sort of trying to have a little theory of mind about the thing. Occasionally, very few of them would go and look in the back of it. Hardly anybody did that. That's what it looks like. It's not as fancy as the front. But it was really instructive to see the way that people played with the thing and the way they looked for games with it. So it's sort of got me thinking. So this is what's in it. It's an embed, which was a weird little ARM platform. I think it still exists, although I've stopped using it. It had a browser-based IDE, and it knew the identity of all the embeds in the world and which ones you had, and it could compile stuff and it went directly onto your device. I don't use it anymore. Anyway, a cheap serial camera. I think it was like 80 pixels across or something. It's an awful camera. And it just did frame-to-frame difference detection, looking for where anything had moved. And it took the center of gravity of all the pixels that had changed, and it pointed the eyeball at that. And that was it, really. It had three servos, and it had one Christmas tree ornament. So it turns out, if you want white spheres of a variety of sizes, which you need if you're going to make eyeballs, you have to buy them at Christmas for people to put them on Christmas trees and keep them the rest of the year. I know no other way to get them. They are really cheap, so you can stock up. So the trickery is, it just uses the center of gravity of the pixels, right? It does not solve the problem that the spectator thinks it's solving. It doesn't find people and look at them. It doesn't know anything about people or looking or anything. It's just finding the center of gravity of all the pixels that are different. So it's solving a much easier problem, which is good because I'm lazy. And with just one person, that's nearly always good enough. So it's a massive cheat, right? A proper computer scientist could spend a year doing this in those days, but I didn't. So, next thing is Sketchy, which really came about by accident. We made a Delta robot out of three servos. Delta robot is this structure, which has all the actuators don't move around, right? If you make an arm, you have to move lots of heavy engineering every time you move. With a Delta robot, everything that moves is very light, so it can be very quick. And it turns out servos are the cheapest actuator you can get and are ideal for making cheap, terrible Delta robots. Bless you. So we were looking for a thing to do with this. We stuck a pen on it. In fact, we stuck this brush pen on it and wrote some software. The box thing at the beginning is a bug. I fixed that after. Sorry. So all this does is we take a picture with a phone, we do some image processing, we extract a bunch of vectors, we send them to the Delta robot, and it draws them. But quite often, it actually made plausible pictures of people. Like, usually, it sort of actually looked like them. I didn't always, but usually. So people were very engaged with it, much more than I thought. Everybody who saw it loved it. If I took it to Maker Faires, there was always a big queue. And I think it was because it was a weird thing, because it was a robot that drew pictures that looked decent, but also it was a thing that, for each person, it was a little thing about them. It was a personal little interaction, and they got this picture to take away. You know, the robot had paid attention to them, and they loved it. The bad thing about it is they loved it. So if you take it along to something like that, you will spend all day, take the picture, explain what it's doing, watch it draw the picture, hand them the picture. Then there's another one, and do it again. So after about 300, you get bored of that. Implementation was an Android app. Edge detected the image, vectorized it, cleaned it up a bit, sent it down to an Arduino, which had a bit of motion control code, very simple, and just drove the servos around. And so the trigonometry to make the Delta robot work, which is code we found on the internet, downloaded, never looked inside it. It was great. Thank you, whoever wrote it. It was marvelous. So trickery again. It turns out all these things have massive cheats in them. So it's hard to distinguish people from the background. If you have a person against a brick wall, it'll spend most of its time drawing bricks. Because the Arduino we used was tiny, we had, I think, a 764-byte limit on the packet that we sent down to the Arduino, so we couldn't draw the bricks. The solution is to take a backdrop along so the picture is always the face and nothing else. Right? Totally a cheat. And you also needed to rig the lighting so you got nice shadows across the face. So as long as you've got one eye socket and one side of the nose, you've basically got a face. If you get anything that might be a mouth, you're winning. If you get a chin, you're done. It's great. So again, it does a terrible job, but it's emotionally effective in doing the thing that people seem to like it doing. And that really is a theme for me, apparently. The giant staring eye I built with Anton, I think we actually invented it on the way back from Ulm in a motorway service station on the M25 when we were very tired and we were talking about how big an eyeball we could make. And we realized it would have to be inflatable. And then I was asked along to a social robot conference. They wanted some social robots that were more interesting than the ones they had, just to kind of show off a bit. So we made this work for them. And again, all this does is it stares at people. There it is, looking for someone. There's someone. It's looking at him very slowly. Oh, still looking at him. There we go. That's the only thing it does. Oh, yeah, the pupil size varies depending on how interested it is. So you can kind of tell when it sees somebody, the pupil gets big. I don't think that showed in that video. So what do people do with it? Sometimes they have staring matches with it. Like with the little eye, they dance around and try to work out what it knows. Occasionally, I only saw this once, but it was very funny, they wouldn't notice there was a giant eyeball looking at them as they walked along, and then they noticed, and then this massive startle. So, you know, it was emotionally effective, but possibly in a slightly unkind way. What's in it? There's a beagle bone. I don't know why we chose a beagle bone. It was what there was. There was a 360-degree lens stuck on a webcam. 360-degree lens is very cheap then. I think they're expensive now. Some failed mobile app that used it. But it's just a lens that takes a whole slice of the world and distorts it into an image that the webcam can see, so you can get all-round view from one camera, which is cheap. Some Python, OpenCV. Again, we're looking for changed areas in the image, but in this case, we were trying to track the largest blob, so you could track a person, even if there were other disturbances around, which kind of worked. Three servos again, and a blower to keep the thing inflated. So turns out central heating boilers, combi boilers, have a blower designed to run down a long duct, which means they generate quite high static pressure, which is what you need for inflatables. So when you throw your boiler away, just keep the blower. I know a lot more than I used to about blowers for inflatables. And the ball itself is just, it's cheap nylon sewn together. I think it's ripstop. I made a spreadsheet and did a bit of trigonometry to work out the shape of the gauze and sewed them together. It's fine. Those are the interesting works. So servos for which way it's looking, and another servo to move that little brass shade, which is the shadow of that is the pupil. So you move that nearer to the light bulb and you get a bigger pupil. The reason that it's so wobbly is because the servos are not really built to have large moments of inertia on them. So if you move it too fast, the servo tends to hunt. Also, that was a really cheap servo. So it's probably my fault. Trickery again. It needs a quiet background. You need to rig it so that there's only going to be a few people walking past it. You can't have, you know, a massive crowd in the background. And apparently the slowness is forgivable. People really don't seem to mind that it's stupidly slow, I think because large things are allowed to be slow. I think there's a whole trick there to exploit with making things that aren't very good, but they're huge, so that's okay. Next up, the tuner on a stick. This was it at SHA. So all this does is spins around all the time. Literally, it spins around all the time. There's no control of the spinning. And it plays a tune based on where people are around it. So that each note is based on the range to the person when the rangefinder was pointed at them. The tune, every time it starts up from nothing, that is when there's been no people, it'll pick a new MIDI patch and a new set of notes, so you get different music when you go back to it. But due to trickery, it's always basically music. This got a very affectionate response. Sometimes people would just be very puzzled by it, which is fair. They would wave their hands at it. Once they knew it sensed them, they'd try and get really close to get some confirmation it was sensing, which is kind of a defect because it doesn't do anything when you're really close. That's a design failure. They'd stand about in groups. Sometimes they would try to play tunes standing around in groups, which I thought was a massive win. But my favorite thing, passers-by who knew it would come and visit. They'd just wander past on their way somewhere and they'd have a little walk around it and then they'd carry on. Just to, you know, have a little play. So it had given them a game that they wanted to come back and do again. They weren't just interested in the mystery of it. They were interested in doing the thing that it offered them. Implementation. A windscreen wiper motor, I think from an Audi. Cogs made from laser cut MDF, which make much better cogs than I thought. It still has the original set. It's, I don't know, like 5 years old or something. There's one slip ring to get the power in. Turns out you can get slip rings cheap on eBay. So that's really just a thing with two halves, wires on both sides. One side rotates with respect to the other. It just takes the mains into this whole spinning assembly. There's one rangefinder. It's an ultrasonic. It's reasonably nice, like a 30 quid ultrasonic. There's an Arduino. There's a MIDI shield. There's like a rat's nest of wires. There's an amplifier, terrible eBay car amplifier, and speakers from a charity shop. That's the inside. Oh, the drum in the middle is the bearings out of an old photocopier drum, because that was the biggest bearing I had handy. But No, cheap stuff, relentlessly cheap. Trickery is, so there's musical trickery, for which most of the credit goes to Phil, who knows much more generative music than me. So it always picks a scale when it's starting up for a new tune, and it picks a subset of the notes from the scale, and it's only going to use those notes. So if you play them in basically any order, it sort of sounds like a tune. May not be a great tune, but definitely a tune. And it only plays notes at the times which it's decided are beats, which I think is 8 per revolution. So it's always in time. It improvises a little drum line to go with it. So you basically don't get horrible not music out of it. So that is the best of the code, right? It's like, find a range, work out what note number you want for that, play the note. There's some other malarkey around it, but really that's the core of it. So, not fancy. It's the world of techno. This plays location-dependent techno. So for every square foot of the planet, there is some techno, it will play there. Different square foot, different techno. That was it, Shah. It's here, but it's a little broken right now, unless my friends back at camp have fixed it. So, okay, but thanks for trying. All I do with it is fire it up, leave it somewhere in a path. Somebody always finds it and they take it somewhere. They push it around. People look after it. These are the only instructions. Without those instructions, people didn't quite get it sometimes. But that's enough. No. Literally, I would be sitting there in a lecture and you'd hear it going past. Somebody's taking it for a walk. So yeah, people would just wander about with it. People would find a favorite spot where they like the techno the best and they sit there and drink beer. When it broke, so this was really instructive actually, if it broke, people would try and charge it or they would fix it. Or they would bring it back very carefully and go, I'm sorry, this is broken, could you fix it? So, I didn't tell them to do that, but because it was abandoned to their care, they looked after it. So I've taken it to, I think, 2 EMFs and I can't remember if there's another one. So it's been in the hands, potentially in the hands of many thousands of people by now, and everybody has been nice. Right? So I think there's another trick there, not a trick really, but this thing about you trust the thing to the people, and the people will usually just be nice to it, which is great. Here it is. I just left it there. This bloke found it and wandered off. Didn't see it for like 4 hours. So what's in it? There's a USB GPS receiver, there's a Pi running Sonic Pi. The music is actually the Sonic Pi acid techno sample with a bit of extra malarkey that we worked out. A terrible car amplifier again. In fact, it's not a terrible car amplifier, that broke and I put a better amplifier in it which cost 15 whole pounds. Charity shop speakers, nice big squishy wheels and an obvious handle. Budget's like maybe 100 quid. Maybe less. There you go. It's technology. It's terrible. Also, it's flat, right? 8 volts. If you make one of these, put some kind of voltmeter in it so that you know when it's not working, that it's not working because it's flat rather than because it's broken. Here's some code. So you see that stuff with lat int percent 1412041. What that's really doing is taking the latitude as a big integer. I can't remember how many digits it is, it's lots of digits, masking out some of the bits. So we're just using some of the bits to control the seed for the note generator for this little loop in Sonic Pi. And then the next line is, again, choosing a chord using some other bits chopped out of the GPS coordinates. So as long as you're using all the bits in the GPS coordinates to do different things, you know that you get different techno for any different coordinates. You don't have any control over what you get, really. You can, by choosing the bit chopping, you can have sort of some aspects vary faster than others as it moves. but that's enough. People often suggest that I should make it play particular techno in particular places, and I think while that would in some ways be awesome, I like the simplicity of this kind of, it just makes it up from the numbers. So trickery. It's got a handle and wheels, and apparently that means you have to push it, right? A designer would call that an affordance. You put the right kind of handle and wheels on, people will push your thing around. The other thing, which is not really a trick, but is trust the camp. Trust the people with your thing, especially if you made your thing really cheap, mostly out of junk you already had. But if you trust the people with your thing, they will look after it and they will shower their affection upon it, I think partly because they have been trusted with it. I'd like to do more of these things that you just leave for people to do their stuff with to see what happens. And again, not really a trick, but almost everybody likes cheap, crappy techno. It's just a thing. You might as well put techno in your thing. The giant tentacle. So this... The eyeball got me thinking about inflatables, and then I started thinking about how you would actuate them, and this was a first go, after some small experiments, at actuating inflatable things, which turned out to be quite practical. So there it is being run off a joystick. There it is a bit later, after Robert helped me put all these range sensors in it. So now it plays little games. It's either, you can't really tell, but depending on its mood, it's either trying to chase people, trying to scoop them up, or it's trying to get away from them, one or the other. Little short-range rangefinder, so it only knows when they're close, and it doesn't know it very well, but that's enough. Apparently, it's eaten Robert. So, people got the game with this, right? So some of them did play chase the thing or be chased by the thing. They would see what it was doing and they would go along with it. They wanted to play the game. Some of them just wanted to squeeze it. Like a significant percentage of people just wanted to run up to it and give it enormous hugs, which again is fine. Some people thought that the end of it was its head, and they would run up to the head and they'd clap at it and wave at it because they thought it would pay attention from that end. So in my mind, it was always more like a tentacle, which has no single focus of attention. So this is, in some ways, a design fail, I guess, that it didn't respond to the thing that they thought it ought to do. If I was energetic, I'd go back and try one that had a head and some sensing and see what other interactions you got. A lot of people wanted to talk about how it works as well. Fair enough, I liked it, so I was very happy to. Implementation is, one, cheap bouncy castle blower. They're cheap, but they're noisy, but they're cheap. The valves for this stuff you have to make, nobody seems to sell valves for this kind of big bore, low pressure pneumatics, so I worked out how to do it from bits of laser cut MDF and ventilation ducting from the hardware store. Compass sensors to measure the bend angles. I tried putting sensors actually between the bits to measure the angles. That was mechanically annoying, and I think Tom, in fact, had the genius idea of just putting compasses in all the segments, because if you know which way each segment's pointing, you know all the angles. So it knows where it is, and it can go to a position it would like to go to and get there reasonably reliably. Time of flight rangefinders, because time of flight rangefinding is the coolest kind of rangefinding, even if it's not the best. And a Wemos, an ESP8266 to run it all, because it cost £4. And you can get these teeny little screens, actually. I've put these in a bunch of things. You get a Wemos and a teeny little OLED, and then it can show you a picture of what it's trying to do while it's trying to do it. And then when it's broken, it's much easier to work out why it's broken. And lots of sewing. There's the valves. The CAD for that is online somewhere. I can point you at it if you want to make these things. Each valve there has a servo in the back that is just turning a big drum that switches the air to go one way or the other. Trickery, all right. If you design that thing properly, because it's all big rounded curved things, that's quite hard. You would need computers and CAD and stuff. But if you just design a bunch of cuboids and parallel flat face things, it'll probably work and it'll come out roughly the shape you expected and be much easier. it doesn't matter if it's leaky, it's not remotely airtight. The blowers are designed to work with big leaky things. Literally, you can put a hole that size in it and it works totally fine. And again, I think because it's big, it's slow, it's not very responsive, but it is responsive, so people tolerate the slowness. They really don't mind. This was the design process. That's a piece of cardboard with some lines drawn on it, which I later measured. That was it. That's not CAD. This was, you know, just checking if it would work again with bits of cardboard. How to Build a Robot was not my project. It was the one that I helped on. It was a built for a TV program. It was a semi-puppeted, semi-autonomous robot which we took out and kind of abandoned in the streets of Bristol and had people interact with. I learned a lot from it. I'm not going to tell you all about it now because it would take like 2 hours. But it is still online. You can find the TV program and find many things. Again, people really looked after this thing. I mean, it looked sort of like a little alien baby thing, and I guess people look after alien babies. They would talk to it. They would give it these big tactile hug interactions very happily. And they were looking after a thing that was abandoned to their care. So it's interesting. How to Build a Robot on Channel 4. It's still available on Catch Up if you want to Google for it. I don't know if you can get any of that stuff in Germany. I'm sorry if you can't. There's probably a way. The Triffid is here and currently also slightly broken, but hopefully that will be working tomorrow. This was, EMF Camp sponsored it last year. Thank you very much, Jonty. Big mobile inflatable thing. I wanted to try a different principle of actuation for inflatables from the tentacle. Totally worked. This Australian lady loved it more than anything else. Lots of other people liked it, but she really liked it. This was a day out at Puppet Place in Bristol, which is a big puppet workshop. At this point, it was manual and is being controlled by that small child you can see with a controller on the right. It turns out she knew exactly how to work it and how to attempt to devour her friends with it. Dear me, those kids were obsessed with it. So come and see it probably tomorrow. It'll be working. The sensing and interaction is a work in progress. At that point, it wasn't really sensing at all. Now it's got some passive infrared sensing on it, which works quite badly. I have a better thing, which, if it works, should be really great. We'll find out. Even if it's not successfully interactive, as long as it's moving about, people think about it and play with it and speculate about what's going on with it, which is interesting. Because it's a sort of big, soft structure, it can have quite a lot of complex motion, even though it only has really 2 degrees of freedom. And so it looks like it's doing more than it really is. People like to play chase games with it. If it ever comes down near them, they'll either go and grab it or they'll run away from it. People like to hug it. Sometimes they like to stick their heads into the spikes, which is hilarious. I'll be interested to see what they do when it's got some new stuff. So, you can come and see the works for this if you want. It's one big bouncy castle blower. The big blowers have slightly higher static pressure. That is the pressure when there's not much flow, which it turns out it needs to lift all the LEDs all the way up. 6 valves, each has one servo, pressure sensors so that it knows the pressure in each of its 3 chambers, so it can servo to the target pressure. Lots of sewing. So I got some friends, Nick and Izzy, came and helped me with the sewing for this. It took a long time, but I think it was worth it. A lot of LEDs, passive infrareds, it's kind of all right. Now sensing with a Jetson Nano. Maybe tomorrow, we'll see. These were just tests on the bend principle, if you like, prototypes to see how spiky you make the spikes to get the most bend out of that structure. There's valve, laser cut hips, one servo, they're about that big. There's a fixnet in a field. Fortunately, Dirk and I had come prepared with sewing machines. The inside, which you can't see anymore, so the bottom is an air box, and then three valves let air into the three vertical cells. Trickery, sort of not even tricks, really. People love big, squishy things. They just do. If they light up, they love them even more. More of this kind of thing. Honestly, you can't go wrong with big, squishy, inflatable light-up things. Massive trick, packs up small. If you want to make a big installation, afterwards you'd have to throw it away or keep it in your house. Both of those are bad, unless it's inflatable, in which case it goes small. So that whole thing goes into a box about this big, which you can put in a car and take back to your house. That is my favorite trick of all. The anemone, all right, so 1 week before EMF last year, Jonty said, we've got a bit more sponsorship, would you like to make another inflatable? Obviously, a sensible person, at this point the Triffitt wasn't really running, so a sensible person would have said no, but I didn't say no because I wasn't sensible, so we made another one. So the anemone was the simplest thing we could make that would kind of hit some of these points. There is at nearly full inflation. So all this does is the pressure inside changes on a cycle, up and down, quite slowly, and as the pressure rises, those little tendril things extrude, and as it falls, they go back in. And the whole thing kind of shrinks a bit as the pressure goes down. And it just sits there and does that all the time. Oh, and it's got LEDs in, obviously. Gets lots of hugs, gets people sticking their heads and arms into the holes. I did see some small children climbing into some of the lower ones, and climbing out is fine. It's really nice to be inside. Sadly, you don't really get the inside experience because there is only a tiny hole to get through now. But it would be nice to experiment some more with that whole making inflated spaces thing. So it's very similar to the Triffitt. It's a big blower. Only two valves, the same design of valve. Two pressure sensors. Bungee cord to pull the nubbins back in. We spend quite a lot of time standing inside it, adjusting the bungees so that they pull back in nicely. Some sewing, not nearly as much sewing, because it's only really got about six parts plus the tubes. We didn't even have a pattern for this, really. We just sort of laid the fabric out on the drive in a big multi-layer thing and cut the shape that we thought would be about the right shape, and it was. So, no sensing, not interactive, still gets interesting interactions by virtue of its kind of physical nature. So that's kind of a lesson. Trickery, right? It just varies its pressure. It's the easiest thing to vary with the bits we had on hand. That's all it does. It's still kind of enough. So that's the end of the list of things. What's next for me, I guess, is trying to work out more of the interaction design and the sensing for where people are. Sensing where people are is kind of annoying and difficult. It shouldn't be, but it is. So I want to do that better. But the other thing is, what these last two have taught me is that people really like these tactile interactions with these things. So even though those weren't designed with it in mind and they don't really respond to it in any useful way, people really go for it. So that's a thing to work on. I don't know what the right thing to do to provide that is, but it's a thing that people want to have somehow. So clearly I should do that. So something tactile experiences. Maybe next year, I don't know. So some kind of conclusion-y things. Making them cheap is... All these things were made really quite shamefully badly. You know, if I was doing it for a job, I wouldn't do that for a job. If somebody was paying me to do it, you would make it nicely and properly, and so it could be serviced, and so it was definitely good enough. But all these things were not, really. They were the worst thing that might possibly work. Really the worst I could imagine that might work to try first, and pretty much always that's turned out to be enough to get an effective installation that you can take to a bunch of places, even if it breaks a little bit, and you can try it on people, and it does the thing. So there's something there about being bold about making your engineering worse and less flashy in order to get more stuff out into the world and in front of people. So cable ties and glue gun, making things from sewing, because sewing is quick and big, and using all of the tricks to have as little actual good stuff in your thing as you can have, just as long as you deliver the effect that you want, right? So that's all about cheap, which I am very much in favor of. And this is about good. So a lot of these wouldn't have been imaginable without the things that came before. Right? There were two eyeballs. There were four, five, I can't even remember, inflatable things. And they all kind of built on each other. So there's a thing there. In fact, Hannah's talk earlier had a point about this, which said it much more eloquently, which was that the people that do a lot of, that get a lot of good stuff out are generally just doing a lot of stuff. Right? The good stuff comes out of just doing and delivering even terrible things, because they give you new bits and building blocks for what you're going to do next. So lots of stuff and lots of iteration and lots of testing on audiences. Try it on people. They won't do what you expect quite often. If you had a genius idea that you loved, that will make you feel stupid, but that's the wrong way to feel, because they've just shown you some other thing you can do. They didn't do what you expected, but they showed you what they wanted. Now you can do it. So you should do it. Might be great, right? So you've got to try it on. They have to be naive audiences. They have to not know the plan. They have to not be your mates, because you can't trust those. They'll tell you it's great. But the other thing is, the experience makes a lot more difference than the object. Right? A clever thing is great, but if people experience your clever thing in a boring way, they haven't gone away with much. So designing the experience is much harder. It's work, but in the end, there's a lot more win from your thing if you design the experience people are going to get, and then they get a good one. Or if you just got lucky and they got a good one by accident, that's also a win, but you can't guarantee that. So giving people something to do, something to learn from your thing, something to interact with and come back to, gets them more stuff out of the thing. The other thing is, a lot of these have a simple, it's not big or clever, it's not, you know, highly theoretical, but some simple attractive thing that makes it go. Right? People love big squishy inflatable things. I know that now, especially with LEDs. They love bobbly techno, they just do. They love to wheel things around. Right? Finding those very sort of primal hooks to base your thing on mean that people will interact with your thing. So look for them. And they're probably things you like already. Right? You can't make things for other people to like that you don't like. So work out what you like, make things that just do that. Apparently, there's meant to be a conclusion at the end. So, making an awesome thing is good, but making an awesome thing with an involving experience is better. In fact, I was probably didn't say it strongly enough there. Making a really shit thing with an involving experience is better. Right? In the end, all you've ever delivered is an experience into somebody, some other human's head. And that's really the thing that sticks in the world, not the thing that you made. The thing you made goes away, but the experience hopefully is kind of sticking. And I think now that a lot of this is just obvious, but I realized I didn't know it before. I tried it, and I put things in front of people, and they did stuff, and then I saw what they did, and then I made more stuff. So I tried it, and I futzed about with stuff that probably wasn't going to work, but in the end kind of did. So go make some things. See what you get. There you go.
Thank you very much for your interesting talk. And now we can have a look at your friends who are back there. They did the fix they intended to.
Did you fix it? Boot it up.
Do think. So, since it's most engaging for the people here, maybe put the Q&A first. That's my...
Yeah. Let's do some Q&A.
Okay.
What have we got?
So we have two microphones, one there, with people holding them. And there's the internet person who's shaking his head. If you have questions.
Audience, thank you. Did you ever try swapping the audience detection methods between, say, the two versions of the eye, or the eye and the tentacle? So, say, you'd have comparing the frames of the serial camera method, but in the tentacle.
No, I never did. It's a good question, but because the way the sensing is integrated into the stuff, it's quite a lot of work to do. If they were better made as more modular things, you could try that. You should try that. Totally try it.
Yeah, thank you.
There's one over there in the middle.
Do you have any tricks for cheaply sourcing appropriate fabric for making these inflatables?
So I found a fabric that was £3 a meter on eBay, in fact. It's a 6-ounce proof nylon. I can show you some. Come over, we'll go and take a look at the Trifid. But that's the cheapest stuff I could find. It's strong enough for these sorts of pressures, and it's reasonably airtight. It's not completely airtight, but you don't need that. So.
Okay, any more questions? Wave like crazy, the lights are very bright. What does the internet say? The internet says nothing at all.
Oh, can I answer a question nobody asked? But, go on.
There's one thing. You said you choose the cheapest, crappiest stuff material that you can find. How often does it happen that it turns out that those things are too crappy?
It's surprisingly really rarely. So I had to replace the amplifier in the world of techno because the connectors just broke off the board and it was too shit. But it got through like 3 hacker camps before that happened. So even then, you know, it's very rare that I just have to throw a whole thing in the bin because it's too terrible. Really isn't a thing. It's kind of amazing, even though I've been doing it for a while. So, yeah.
So there's another one, yes?
So the world of techno, how do you deal with the drift in GPS locations?
The techno changes. I literally pay that no attention.
More questions from the audience. There's one over here in front.
All of these are quite nice and squishy. Have you considered making something that scares people?
No, not really, but now I think I should.
Okay, more from the audience. Jackman, do you have a question?
Well, I have an answer. So if you want to make things like this, there's mostly source code and some CAD files and constructional detail online. You can probably find it by Googling for the names of the things or off my website or send me mail. Nearly all of those were collaborative projects. Are we happy to collaborate on more of that kind of stuff or just to tell you about it in case you accidentally go and make something awesome? So, yeah, send me a mail.
Then I would say thank you again, Jackman, and a big round of applause for him.